One of the funniest writers in America is Simon Rich. Simon has written for Saturday Night Live and Pixar, but he's probably best known for his hilarious short stories. His latest collection is called Hits and Misses. It's inspired by Simon's real experiences in Hollywood.
The first story is about a struggling novelist. His wife is pregnant, and he's trying to finish up his novel before the baby is born because he realizes, you know, when that happens, he's not going to have as much time to focus on his writing. As he's working on it, he checks the sonogram, and he notices two things about his unborn child. One is there's a penis, so he knows that it's going to be a boy, but then there's also a pencil. And the doctor explains that that means that he's going to give birth to a writer.
Yeah.
And everybody else is pretty excited about it, but he, as a struggling writer himself, can't help but feel increasingly competitive with his unborn child, who is, from within the womb, writing what turns out to not just be a good novel, but possibly the great American novel.
Yeah. Yeah. Now would be the perfect time to have you read an excerpt from The Baby.
Sure thing. Okay. Dr. Kowalski was his usual upbeat self as he booted up the high-tech 4D scanner. But when he put on his glasses and squinted at the screen, his face went slack. "My God," he murmured softly. "My God in heaven." "What's wrong?" Sue asked the doctor. Dr. Kowalski swiveled around and laughed. "I am sorry," he said. "Everything is fine with baby health. It is just this thing fetus is writing. It is so engrossing." He shook his head with amazement. "I forgot there were other people in room. Until you spoke, I was just, like, in it." Sue exhaled with relief. She tried to squeeze Ben's hand, but his fingers were limp. He leapt up and hurried toward the scanner. "How did he get that typewriter?" he asked. Dr. Kowalski shrugged. "Is normal at 25 weeks. Ben was disturbed to notice that the fetus was using a hip vintage Underwood. He was almost certainly a novelist and probably a literary one. "What's he writing?" he asked, trying to sound casual. "His historical novel," said Dr. Kowalski, "about General Custer." Ben's heart raced. "He's writing about General Custer?" "Yes," said the doctor, "but it is about so much more than that. It is suspenseful, lyrical. In some ways, it is a story of America itself." "Wow," Sue said. "That sounds pretty good. Right, honey? Right?" "He stole my idea," Ben murmured as they climbed up to their fifth-floor Brooklyn walk-up. "How is that even possible?" Sue asked. She was exhausted and a little out of breath. "They can hear stuff through the womb," Ben said. "He must have heard me talking about it or something." "But you never talk about your work," Sue reasoned. "I mean, until today, I had no idea you were starting a book about General Custer." "I'm not starting it. I'm finishing it. I'm up to the last chapter, damn it." "It's going to be fine," she said soothingly. "There can be two books about the same thing, right?" But Ben had already bounded up the stairs, leaving her to walk up the final flight alone.
That was great. Thank you. It's such a funny story, and I really love the surreal, Kafkaesque, dream logic nature of it. Is that the way you originally wrote the story, or did you start with a more realistic, logical draft?
Good question. No, this one always kind of had that big surreal hook right at the top. And it's flattering that you mentioned Kafka because obviously he's a really big influence on my writing.
So how are you able to do that? Can you describe how you're able to turn off the rational part of your brain to write these fantastical, surreal stories?
They're always very personal stories, but I don't really realize how personal they are when I'm sitting down to write them.
Mm-hmm.
So in hindsight, this story is very autobiographical because I wrote it when my wife was pregnant, and I, like the protagonist of that story, am a writer, and I was dealing with all the usual things that expectant parents deal with. What does this mean for me? You know, I'm handing the baton to a new generation. Does this mean my life is over? And I was dealing with all those sort of insecurities, but I didn't sit down, you know, with the goal of, like, finding a metaphor. I just kind of wrote what I felt that day, and it was, you know, what if this kid inside that womb is a better writer than I am? And what if he's writing right now? Of course, it ended up not even being a boy. But, you know, so your characters always, I think, whether you want to admit it or not, have something in common with yourself.
Yeah.
But I think writing from a surreal point of view, it allows me to have, ironically, enough distance from myself that I'm able to be a little bit more emotionally honest, maybe, than I would be if I was writing, like, a straight-ahead memoir, which is actually something I've never even attempted.
That's very interesting.
I don't know it's about me when I'm writing it. It's only like a year later when I'm reading the book on the radio and I'm like, oh, huh, that's pretty personal.
Yeah. The comedian John Mulaney says that Simon Rich is the Stephen King of comedy writing. So does that mean that Stephen King is the Simon Rich of horror writing?
I mean, I think he's worthy of maybe higher praise than that. He's one of my favorite writers ever, and really nice of John to say that about me. Stephen King is bizarrely a huge influence on my own writing, which you maybe wouldn't expect because I'm a comedy writer and King writes almost exclusively horror. One of the things that I find so inspiring about his work is that he's a genius at coming up with really excellent surreal metaphors to describe some pretty visceral aspects of the human experience. So, like, if you look at a book like Carrie, for example, even though Carrie's own experience is way weirder and stranger than that of any adolescent, it really captures how it feels to be a teenage outcast. I connected more to Carrie than I did to, like, the protagonists of, for example, like a Judy Blume novels, which are great as well. But there's something about the surrealism of King where it hits you in a more visceral level. Or something like Misery, which is probably my favorite book about writing, but again, told through this insane metaphor of the reader as a deranged obsessive who chains you to a bed and demands excellence.
Yeah.
So King and Kafka are really big influences on me, even though they're not straight-ahead comedy writers.
Yeah. So you see a connection between the horror and humor genres?
Oh, yeah. Big time. Big time.
What's the connection?
Well, I think, you know, the use of metaphor, but also just high stakes, big hooks, above all, just kind of a visceral, emotional streak that runs through it. You know, I think the best horror really hits you in the gut. You know, you really feel it on an emotional level from page one. And that's what the best comedy does, too.
Yeah. Another one of my favorite stories in Hits and Misses is called Riding Solo, the Oatsy story. Can you tell me a bit about this one?
Sure thing, yeah. So this is a tell-all memoir written from the point of view of Paul Revere's horse, who is understandably a little bit bitter that he didn't get as much credit as he feels is due for the midnight ride.
Yeah, would you mind reading the opening?
Sure thing.
Thank you.
Growing up horse, I do not expect much from life. My 10 older brothers all end up in stable. My sisters become glue. When I am small, my father run off. That is not figure of speech. One day, for real, he just run into woods out of nowhere. Everyone is like, whoa, that crazy. It is not happy barn, but I have one escape, running. When I am doing gallop, I do not think about how little hay we have or where I will next find salt. I think only of wind in my mane as I surge through the air like bird. In that moment, I am happy. I am free. Around this time, I meet human. His name Paul. Paul Revere. He was not big star then. He was just regular guy from Boston. Laid back, funny, easy to carry. We become close and tell our secrets. Turns out we both have same dream. To make big mark on world. One night, when moon is up, we make pact. If one of us make it, we both make it. Together, there is no stopping us. Then one day, we see British coming, and I am like, this is it. This is our chance. We can ride to town and tell people British are coming, and it will be like this big thing. Paul is scared, and he is like, are you sure that is a good idea, Oatsy? And I am like, trust me. I know what I talk about. So Paul cannot run fast because he has fat legs, and also he is human. So he is like, hey, can you do running part? And I am like, of course. I will carry you whole way to town, and when we get there, you can do speaking part, since you are not horse and you know English and can talk. And he is like, deal.
That was great. Thank you.
Sure.
I love the diction that you've given Oatsy. I dare say that if the writers of Mr. Ed had given him that kind of diction, the show might still be on the air.
It's a great show and a missed opportunity for them.
Very well said. Many of your stories could be described as tragic comedies. Why do you often include tragic elements in your work?
It's not done intentionally, but yeah, I think you are right to say that. I guess I'm always interested in characters who are in some kind of predicament.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also interested in characters who are naive in some way. Most, if not all, of my protagonists know less than the reader knows. They tend to be inanimate objects or animals or have some kind of flaw, you know, in the case of the struggling novelist and the baby. In that story, you know, he has this deep insecurity. So I always try to write from a place of weakness and frailty. So I think that that sort of lends itself to that kind of tragicomic tone. But I try to give my characters redemption most of the time. I would say occasionally one of my stories will have a pretty bleak ending, but typically the character learns something or achieves some kind of success by the end.
And as the visionary science fiction author Philip K. Dick once said, quote, "It really seems to me that in the midst of great tragedy, there is always the horrible possibility that something terribly funny will happen," end quote. And I guess it works the other way around too, doesn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. I'm a science fiction fan as well. You know, there's a reason why when you watch the Simpsons Halloween specials, why so many stories are modeled after Twilight Zone episodes or Philip Dick premises. There's a thin line between horror and comedy.
Yeah. You were one of the youngest writers ever to work for Saturday Night Live, and you've also worked as a staff writer for Pixar. I'm curious about how those experiences have shaped your fiction.
Well, Pixar, I think, really had a big effect on my storytelling strategy, just because they're so rigorous with their character arcs and with their narrative structure. And so I think I just learned a lot there about how to tell a story with a beginning, a middle, and an end. And so I feel really fortunate for that. The big thing SNL taught me was just kind of how to imitate different idioms. You know, when you're writing like satire, it's really important to capture in a sentence a certain tone or style. Mm-hmm. And since my writing, you know, I tend to move around from like genre to genre, imitation is like a big part of what I do. For example, in one of my collections, I have a Sherlock Holmes story.
Yeah.
And, you know, or I'll do like a Lewis Carroll knockoff. I think I'm using those Saturday Night Live muscles whenever I'm trying to truly satirize a specific voice or writer.
Yeah, or like in the new book, the Hitler GQ parody.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, celebrity profile parody about Hitler. That definitely is straight-ahead satire.
Simon Rich is the author of Hits and Misses. And remember, there are no misses when you visit us online at wpr.org/beta.
Jack Kerouac talked about writing, and he said, when you get stuck, get the picture in your mind. Don't try to think of the words and what to say, but pick it up in your mind's eye.
Sam Phillips talks about her cinematic album, World on Sticks. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio.